Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. When I was doing the research for the chapter in the book Relational Reality about health and healthcare, now specifically this was a chapter about all the new discoveries demonstrating that reality, including the human body, is way more dynamically interrelated than modernity had suspected. It's interrelated internally, parts of the body to parts of the body, interrelated with the way we're affected by relations with other people, and of course, relations with the rest of the natural world, interactions. So it's basically a good news book, but I figure, well, I'll start that chapter with a little snapshot of the status quo. I mean, what's happening with health and well-being right now in our country? So I was often shocked at what came up in that snapshot. For instance, a study of umbilical cord blood from babies born in United States hospitals between August and September 2004 found an average of 200 synthetic chemicals and pollutants in the umbilical cord blood, including mercury, flame retardants, pesticides, PFOA, which is used to make Teflon, and others. In total, the baby's umbilical blood contained 297 chemicals, 209 of which had never been detected in cord blood before. And in a similar vein, breast milk, the breast milk of all mothers, now contains industrial chemicals. In many parts of the United States, it would, if bottled, be too toxic to gain FDA approval to be sold. So, tragically, mother's milk has become a stew of PCBs, DDT, dioxin, flame retardants, and other toxins. Yeah, it's too bad we never get a State of the Human report from our government, or a State of the Earth report either, or rather one combined report on the thoroughly interrelated fates of the human and the earth. Maybe something called the Eco-Social Index. Then we could see how we're doing. You may recall that when Joanna Macy was on this program a few weeks ago, she mentioned Dr. Rosalie Bertels, and that immediately brought to my mind Dr. Bertels' rather famous diagnosis in the early 1980s, quote, "The diagnosis for the human race is slow death by poisoning." Actually, she said human species, of course, being a scientist, unquote. These many decades later, the governmental agencies of the European Union, for instance, have taken significant action to test, to determine which industrial chemicals can be used safely and which are hazardous and should be outlawed. In our own country, the situation is very different. Of the 82,000 industrial chemicals registered for commercial use in the United States today, only about 7 in use have been subjected to testing thorough enough to determine developmental or reproductive toxicity, and usually nothing happens then. So we are, all of us and our children, the guinea pigs. Worse still, even with all the cancer and all the neurological disorders showing up in our children and the obesity and metabolic syndrome of Americans of all ages, all of which have been linked with synergistic effects of environmental toxins, our government, that is, both parties, allow the situation to keep getting even worse. For instance, agribusiness is continually pushing to get government approval to increase the huge amount of toxic substances they're permitted to put into our environment. Just yesterday, I got an email. It was a general email announcement from the Center for Food Safety in Washington, D.C. that said, quote, "Stop Monsanto's dicamba-tolerant soybeans. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is currently considering approval of Monsanto's new genetically engineered dicamba-tolerant soybeans. If approved, millions more pounds of this hazardous chemical will be sprayed, polluting our food, water, and air. This is just the latest effort in the corporate chemical arms race, and it will cause serious harm to human health and the environment. Since the introduction of genetically engineered crops, herbicide use has increased by nearly 400 million pounds in the United States, Why? 84% of the genetically engineered crops planted today are designed to withstand massive application of highly toxic herbicides without dying, unquote. So, you know, what they're saying is the genetically engineered crops don't die, but the super weeds then emerge, and the highly toxic herbicides are carried by the air and the wind, and they also are in the runoff with rainwater and irrigation water, and it goes into our groundwater. And there was another announcement, again, from the Center for Food Safety the day before that. Tell USDA to reject, quote, Agent Orange soybeans. Dow Chemical is currently requesting yet another unprecedented USDA approval, a genetically engineered version of soybeans that's resistant to 2,4-D, which was a major component of the highly toxic Agent Orange, the chemical defoliant that was used in aerial spraying by the United States military in Vietnam. It caused lasting ecological damage as well as many serious medical conditions in both the American veterans of that war and the Vietnamese, unquote. So these are just a few examples of the ongoing crisis that the corporations managed to keep off the table regarding government regulation. Jim Hightower, just before my program, explained how that works. Yeah, they're invited into those meetings with the top-level officials, no matter which party's in office. But here's the thing. Even as we were struggling with all those sources of toxic substances in our lives, including all the Superfund toxic sites that never did get cleaned up, in the midst of all that, a new and vast source of pollution, this time irreversible because it pollutes the groundwater, was unleashed in 2005. It's high-volume slickwater hydraulic fracturing, or, for short, fracking. My guest today is one of the foremost authors and activists addressing both of these huge problems, toxins in the environment and fracking. To give you a little more context before I introduce her, though, I think you need to know about this hair-raising extent to which the fracking corporations have been able to buy off state-level and federal officials via large campaign contributions. So this is the same old story. All roads lead to campaign finance reform. If we don't get that, which neither of the two big parties want, we can never get rid of the corporate corruption of our democracy. Here's an example. In my home state of Ohio, Governor Kasich, Republican Governor Kasich, has received more than $200,000 from the oil and gas industry in the past 4 years, making him the state's top recipient of campaign contributions from those companies. And so, soon after taking office in January 2011, Governor Kasich opened 200,000 acres in Ohio's state parks, beautiful state parks, for drilling, and he appointed a former oil and gas executive to run the state's Department of Natural Resources, following the way the Bush administration did it, and Reagan's administration as well, put the corporate people in charge of the so-called regulatory agencies. But here's the thing. In May, just a few months ago, the governor approved new fracking rules for Ohio that will, among other things, prohibit Ohio citizens or local governments from appealing any drilling permits that his administration gives them. And it will prevent doctors from disclosing whether patients' ailments might be or probably related to fracking. They have the same gag rule now on doctors in Pennsylvania. They're not allowed to write scientific articles about what they're seeing in their patients living near the fracking sites. It's really astounding. And finally, these new laws he's proposing in May will allow for well casings to be set within 50 feet of groundwater aquifers. That's only half the distance that's recommended by the American Petroleum Institute. So he's already allowed Northwest Ohio to become the dumping ground for the wastewater from the fracking in Pennsylvania. They truck it over there. and 511 million gallons of flowback wastewater has now been injected into 176 wells in Ohio's permeable bedrock. And this was the cause, even the state admitted, of several earthquakes last year in northeastern Ohio. I hope I said northeastern before, not northwestern. Yeah. Anyway, so corruption abounds and getting worse. Finally, the fracking companies like to point out that the influx of natural gas replacing coal to some extent in our country has lowered the levels of carbon dioxide emissions for our country, and so it's necessary to allow even more fracking in the coming years. Yeah, well, I would like to remind them that there are other non-poisoning ways to reduce our carbon emissions. For instance, just a few months ago in May, during 2 days, through the midday high peak hours, solar power plants in Germany produced and fed into their national power grid a world record 22 gigawatts of electricity per hour. That's equal to 20 nuclear power stations at full capacity. And this solar-generated electricity met nearly 50% of Germany's midday electricity needs. Now, that was in Germany, where the skies are often gray and overcast, unlike the vast sun belt we have in this country. The point is that disrupting and poisoning our land and water through fracking is simply not necessary. It just makes millions of dollars, however, in profit for the fracking corporations, who are now pushing to develop export channels for much of the natural gas they're going after by blowing up the ecological integrity of our subsurface geological formations. I mean, really, if intensified drilling for gas and oil in recent years were truly about the national security of our energy supply, we would have a federal law saying all fossil fuel recovered in the United States must be sold here. Instead of being hustled on the global market for gargantuan corporate profits. But we don't have that kind of a law. And as you may have heard in Bill Clinton's speech last night, it was just, oh, isn't this great? More natural gas production. We're really on it. Okay, so much for the context. My guest today is Sandra Steingraber. She holds a Ph.D. in biology and is a recipient of the Rachel Carson Leadership Award. She's testified at congressional briefings and has lectured before the Parliament of the European Union, various medical conferences, and on numerous college campuses. Sandra Steingraber is the author of many articles and 3 books. Now, the first book in 1997 was Living Downstream, an ecologist's personal investigation of cancer and the environment. And that important book subsequently became the subject of an award-winning Canadian film of the same name, Living Downstream. It was from that work that I've been loosely tracking her writing ever since, whenever I happen upon it. Her second book was Having Faith. Faith is the name of her daughter. Having Faith, and the subtitle is An Ecologist's Journey into Motherhood. And her new book is Raising Elijah. Elijah is the name of her son. Subtitle of Raising Elijah is Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. Sandra Steingraber is a recipient of the Environmental Health Champion Award from Physicians for Social Responsibility, Los Angeles. And in 1910, she was named one of the 25 visionaries who are changing your world by Utney Reader. She lives with her husband and 2 children, ages 9 and 12, in Ithaca, New York, where she's a visiting scholar at Ithaca College. She's also a poet and a columnist and contributing editor at Orion Magazine. And I want to call your attention especially to an important article she has in the current issue of Orion. Orion is spelled O-R-I-O-N, and the essay is titled The Fracking of Rachel Carson, which we'll talk about later in the program. Sandra Steingraber, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks, Charlene. Thanks for having me.
Well, I find your new book, Raising Elijah, to be very impressive on a number of counts. And to orient the readers, I wonder if you could I'd like them to get a little flavor of your writing as well as the ideas we'll talk about. So could you read that passage that's in the foreword toward the end where you talk about the aims of the book?
Let's see. In the foreword toward the end.
Well, it's the bottom of page small numeral 16.
Okay.
Raising Elijah, I seek a path out of that despair. Because I think so many of us are feeling despair about the situation.
Okay. In Raising Elijah, I seek a path out of despair. This book is not about shopping differently. Indeed, it rejects altogether the notion that toxicity should be a consumer choice. Instead, it seeks the higher ground of human rights, in which to explore systemic solutions to the ongoing chemical contamination of our children and our biosphere. And because I believe that stories move us to action more than data alone, the scientific evidence is strapped to the hood of an autobiographical tale that begins with the birth of my son and spans the first 9 years of my life as a biologist mother of two.
Yeah, and then that just that one more paragraph, throughout these chapters I've discovered... Because
I've
that tells
that
people exactly how you link it to the daily happenings of parenting young children. It's really well thought through and well, it's going to be so helpful for so many people.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll just describe that chapter. So essentially, this book is kind of two books in one, where I look at the threats of environmental threats to child development from birth up until puberty, there's also a sort of a memoir of my own life as a former field ecologist, now trying to run the sort of messy ecology of my own household and understand the behavior of these two mammals who live in them, namely my two kids. And so I tell stories about how I, as a biologist mother, tried to confront basically the most urgent public health issue of our time, because, in fact, the domestic routines of life with young children, even though they seem isolated and detached from public life, they're actually very much part of global systems of agricultural subsidies and our transportation and energy policies and even national security issues. For example, the floor that my kitchen is made out of, PVC tile, this kind of banal floral pattern that I mop and sweep on a regular basis. PVC is made from natural gas, which is increasingly is from fracking, and the facility in which natural gas is turned into vinyl chloride, the monomer for PVC plastic, occurred not far from my hometown where I grew up in Illinois. That facility blew up in 2004 because of a innocent mistake made by an exhausted worker and spread dioxin and all kinds of toxics all around, and three counties had to be evacuated and so forth. And so I go back to visit that community that was basically kind of ground zero in the middle of the prairie, and talk about national security issues and chemicals that can explode like this, and at the same time make the connection with my own kitchen floor.
Mm-hmm.
So the book moves back and forth between the domestic and the big and the political.
Yeah, and that's why I think it'll be so useful to people. I think people would want to give this book, Raising Elijah, to expectant mothers, parents, and also parents of young children. And they might think, oh, well, no, I wouldn't want to scare them by talking about that kind of thing. But, you know, I know a mother of a young child who has so many neurological problems, and she ate several cans of tuna fish every week throughout pregnancy because she thought that was the best way to give nutrition for brain development in the fetus. And of
I think, you know, once you become a parent, as soon as you become pregnant, the idea that you can put your hands over your ears and just say la 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 whenever you hear bad news, that is gone. I mean, it's kind of our job as parents to be informed and to know what threats are out there, whether it is a pedophile who's, you know, located in our neighborhood or car seat recalls or vaccination schedules, all of these things that were never on our radar screens before. As parents, it's our job to protect our kids from harm. That's probably the fundamental duty of parenting. And so we have a right, not only do we have a right to know, we have a kind of duty to inquire about what the threats are. And for me, as a biologist who studies environmental health, a lot of the threats to my children, whether it's to the way their brains are wired together or my son's history of asthma, the age at which my daughter enters puberty, all of these things are linked to our chemicals policy. They're linked to our transportation systems and our energy policy. And so I'm required, it feels to me, to insert myself into these big public conversations. It's part of my job as a mom.
Right. But so much of so many of the young parents in this age are socialized in a different direction, as you say, to ignore it. And you make a good case that we can't do that anymore, but that's the way people are directed. So what I think is so valuable about this book, and no one would object to reading it and would be very grateful if they did read it, is the way you weave it together with, as you say, the daily occurrences of parenting. And you're also very witty. You're poetic writer and a witty writer.
Thank you. I mean, and this is my most funny book, and I really wanted that in there.
But you admit, too, to the fact that, you know, parenting young children is a matter of keeping a lot of balls in the air, and sometimes a ball drops. You know, you say, oh, well, gee, I wish I'd done that a little differently, or things happen, things are always happening. So all that is in there, which is what I think would make it so engaging to young parents. So that said, about why I think this could really provide a great service if the book is given to a lot of people. Let's get into some examples. As you say, there was the kitchen floor. You have also what happened when, let's say, you were about to have the new baby, or maybe did already, and you and your husband look around for a preschool for your three-year-old daughter, and you find a good one, and what happens then?
Right. So, of course, choosing a preschool is a very fraught sort of activity, and so we thought we made a good decision, but it turned out the big play structure out back was made out of pressure-treated wood, the old-fashioned kind that has arsenic in it. And my daughter was in school at about the time the EPA was making its own big national policy decision on whether or not to remove this product from to ban it, and they did. So, but they stopped short of requiring that pre-existing structures made out of arsenic be recalled. And so the situation then was no more new structures could be made out of this, out of the admission that the arsenic that was what. So basically, pressure-treated wood is arsenic-treated wood, right? It's a kind of embalming process for wood. So you suck out all the sap, and you replace it with this chromated arsenic compound that then kills bugs and fungus on contact, and that allows you to make backyard playsets and decks and things like that. And it's very heavy wood, and that's because there's a lot of arsenic in it. And the arsenic is water soluble. It leaches out. It gets on children's hands, and the EPA determined through careful study that it created a serious enough exposure risk for kids. Arsenic is a known human carcinogen. And children are at high risk because they don't have the enzymes and the sort of the defense systems that we biological adults do to detoxify arsenic. Not good for us either, but a child actually who is exposed to arsenic has a longer residence time of arsenic in their body because they don't pee it out as efficiently as we do. And so all this is considered a demonstrable threat to kids, so no more CCA wood is going to be sold after a certain date. And that has corresponded to my own daughter's life in preschool. Well, that's all fine and good, but no one's going to come and help us deal with our leaking arsenic-treated structure in my daughter's nursery school. So two of us biologist moms took matters into our own hands and did some soil testing and sampling according to the protocols that we know how to do. And it turns out there's 17 times higher the arsenic level than would be allowed in a Superfund site after a cleanup. And this is what our three-year-olds are, you know, making mud pies out of this soil underneath this structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the kind of drama that followed among all the parents who are realizing that we have a problem, that our own government acknowledges that there's a problem, but there's no solution for it. And if we want to dismantle this thing ourselves and send it to a hazardous waste landfill, we're on our own. We have to pay for this ourselves. And so what do you do when you know there's a problem but you can't solve it? How do you react? And of course, everyone goes to a different place in this. Some people feel like if you can't solve it, therefore it's not a problem, right? And so you see this kind of solidarity among concerned parents when we first got the results back from the lab evolve into basically a big fractured community. And then, you know, ultimately my daughter couldn't stay there anymore. So I tell that little sort of tempest in the teapot as I think the story that I think a lot of parents are in, which is not that we don't want to know that there's a problem. It's just that once you know, you can't not know. And knowing in the absence of a solution simply fills people with despair. And psychologists actually have a name for this state. It's called well-informed futility syndrome. And that's where I think a lot of us parents find ourselves. You know, we're futilely well-informed. We don't like feeling that way. So then we decide, you know what? I just don't want to even hear about this anymore. There's nothing I can do, so I don't want to hear about arsenic anymore. I don't want to hear about pesticides in food. I don't want to hear about fracking. I'm just going to kind of live in this cocoon along with my child where no bad words and no bad news and scary things penetrates. And that's where we begin to abdicate our responsibility, I think, as parents. We're terrified of telling our children about climate change or something like that, and so therefore we don't tell ourselves about it either. We don't let any of that into our own houses. And then we lose the opportunity to really make a big change. So I, as a parent, I'm determined to march my readers out of that bad place and also live in a different place myself. So I live a very different kind of life than a lot of other mothers, but I think it's a life that we all need to be living in, and that's what I advocate in Raising Elijah. I actually named the book after my son Elijah, but my son himself is named after an abolitionist from my home state of Illinois, Elijah Lovejoy, who advocated dismantling slavery and divorcing our economy from its dependence on slave labor at a time in the 1830s when our economy was hopelessly bound up in slavery, and it kept the cost of goods low. It kept us competitive on the world market. Everyone benefited from slave labor, whether you lived in a free state or a slave state, and everybody sort of recognized that. So we were regulating slavery by like the Missouri Compromise, right? So Maine would be free, but Missouri would be slave, and we try to keep a balance and have state-of-the-art slavery. But in fact, that position, we ended the slave trade from Africa and so forth, but that the regulatory response to slavery was ultimately a failure. I mean, it was the extremists of the day, the abolitionists, who just said, this has to stop. This is an abomination that we now look at as the heroes. And so I want to be a carcinogen abolitionist. I want to be an abolitionist around fossil fuels. I want to resurrect the spirit of Elijah Lovejoy, raise up Raising Elijah for our current age, in an age of environmental crisis. And the first step to that is the willingness to look around and see what the problem is. So in my own life today, I woke up very early this morning and put all the dinner in the crock pot and made school lunches, sent my kids off to school, and then I went to a fracking protest. I just got back from jail. I myself wasn't arrested, but I was with three people who were arrested for chaining themselves to a fence at a compressor station, which is part of the apparatus for natural gas extraction in New York State, and then drove the defendant's car. You know, when she got out of jail, she would have her car and her pocketbook back, and got here just in time for this interview. So
I see.
Then I will pick my son up at school, right? So I spent half my day sitting in the cop shop waiting for the defendants to come out, and half my time reading recipes for crock pots. That's fine. We can hold these things in our heads and be these kinds of parents, I think.
Right. That's Your story from today is exactly what I was hoping to get into. Step one is wake up. Step two, people have to become activists. This isn't going to change unless there's a big grassroots demand of political will. We have to stop now for the break. We'll get into fracking after the break. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Sandra Steingraber. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Sandra Steingraber, about her new book, Raising Elijah. And by the way, she has a lovely and richly informative website, which is steingraber.com. That's steingraber.com. So let's move into this other subject you've written a lot about, fracking. And I'd like you to start out by telling the listeners what you call the five sure things regarding fracking.
Well, fracking, of course, is a shorthand for hydraulic fracturing. And it really refers to using fresh water as a club to smash apart the bedrock below our feet, injecting it with toxic chemicals, which cause gas bubbles that are trapped in there to flow up and out the borehole. So essentially, fracking is one of four forms of extreme energy extraction that is a path that we're now blazing. Having run out of early, easy-to-get fossil fuel, we are now blowing up mountaintops for coal. That's mountaintop removal. That's one form of extreme energy extraction. Another is, of course, deep-sea oil drilling. That's what brought us to BP oil spill in the Gulf. And then the tar sands pipeline, which refers to cutting down boreal rainforests in northern Canada, and then cooking the soil underneath that forest and extracting the tar, sending the tar into pipelines that go all the way down to southern Louisiana, and then turning that into gasoline. That would be the third form. And then the fourth one is fracking, which is bringing up these tiny bubbles of methane that are trapped in the shale bedrock a mile below our feet in areas where the bedrock is shale. And I live atop of one of those shale layers called the Marcellus Shale here in upstate New York. And those bubbles are trapped in a sort of a horizontal spread of shale, like champagne bubbles kind of trapped in rock. So to blow up the shale to bring all those bubbles to the surface is what fracking is. And there are three, as you mentioned, five things that we know for sure about fracking. There are a lot of unknowns about fracking. But one of them is you can't do this without turning the land inside out. So in here above the Marcellus Shale, and of course New York is the third most populous state in the nation, so it's a very densely populated state. Even our rural areas are just full of, you know, farms and communities, and you have to industrialize this landscape. You have to build out thousands of gas wells and essentially invite these big energy companies to turn our rural areas into their factory floors, right, in our communities, because hydraulic fracking is combined with horizontal drilling to get this gas out. So the well bore has to bore down a mile below our feet and then turn sideways and, like a robotic mole, tunnel along sideways for another mile or more. And remember, these are tiny bubbles. You don't get a lot of gas from any one well, so you're going to spread these out across the landscape. Now, I'm writing in New York State, where we have a moratorium on fracking thanks to the foresight of our former governor, Patterson. And our current governor, Andrew Cuomo, is debating and trying to decide whether to maintain or lift the current moratorium. So the fight here in New York State is a fight to keep fracking out. Just to our south, our sister state of Pennsylvania is fighting fracking under far more difficult circumstances. They never enjoyed a moratorium, and so this whole technology began rolling across the state, and they were just kind of hit by it. By a truck with this, and so they're fighting to stop new fracking permits and get it, you know, just slow this horrible thing down. So turning the land inside out and just and industrializing the rural landscape is one thing we know for sure. It destroys forests, it destroys habitat for birds and so forth. The other thing we know for sure about fracking is you can't do it without laying down a blanket of smog across the landscape. And that's because we need, first of all, we need so much water to frack. We need 2 to 8 million gallons of water per well, right? And there are tens of thousands of wells. So we're talking about billions of gallons of water, all which have to be carried in big tanker trucks. We need 50,000 gallons of chemicals for every well. Mm-hmm. And those are also brought in. And then we need compressor stations and condenser stations, you know, to compress the gas when it comes out and put it in the spider web of pipeline and get it to market. And so those also emit smog-making volatile chemicals like formaldehyde and benzene and toluene. And then the gas wells themselves begin emitting there's more than just methane down there. There's all kinds of other hydrocarbons that are vapors that begin to come out as soon as the well is drilled. And so everywhere you see fracking in the United States, you see problems with air quality. The third thing we know first that happens with certainty is accidents. This is a very accident-prone industry, and not surprising because we're talking about an accident that we're talking about an industry that's trying to extract explosive vapors, and so you have things like gas pockets exploding. You have trucks that haul the toxic liquid that are crashing. You have waste pits. A lot of the inject the water with the chemicals under intensely explosive pressure to blow apart the shale, when you release the pressure, what flows back up out of the hole is not just the bubbles of gas, but some of that water and chemicals that you put down in the hole, mm-hmm. along with a lot of brine and uranium and radium and heavy metals and other things that are trapped deep within these geological strata. So those come flying back out of the hole, and then they're put often in big waste pits that begin to leak and so forth. So this is a very accident-prone industry. And then the fourth thing is that this makes water disappear. You need to take 2 to 8 million gallons of water per well, and you essentially make it exit the hydrologic cycle. You entomb it far below the water table in the shards of bedrock that you've blown apart, and there the water sits. And we hope actually it never comes back because it's now top poisonous. Mm-hmm. At a time where we know that climate change is threatening our water supply, we are taking water away from rivers and streams, fresh water, and burying it. We've never done that before as humans, made water disappear from the hydrologic cycle. So that's something new under the earth. And then, of course, the fifth thing we know with certainty is that sooner or later, this gas is going to run out. It's a fossil fuel. It's a non-renewable resource, and as in, God's not putting any more of it in the ground. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that we are investing, using our capital investment dollars to build out this incredible industry that is temporary at best, rather than using those dollars to build out, let's say, solar or wind or something that will really sustain us for the long haul, is an obscenity to me, both as a mother whose children need an abiding ecology, you know, for their own lives, but also as a biologist who believes that the fossil fuel party is rapidly coming to an end, and any more investment in it is just a huge waste of time and money, and that's probably the best thing you can say about it.
Yeah, and just last December, you've mentioned in this article I want to talk about that the Institute of Medicine did affirm this possible link between benzene and breast cancer. Benzene's known to cause leukemia and birth defects, and people living near these wells are exposed to benzene in many cases.
Well, that's a smart thing to say. Right. So this is really a women's issue in some ways. Benzene also causes leukemia and birth defects. Mm-hmm. But we know from good studies in Colorado that benzene comes out of fracking wells in a way that it creates measurable health risks for people living in downwind in the communities where fracking, drilling and fracking operations exist. So if you are a woman, not only do you have an increased risk of leukemia along with everyone else, but also we have troubling evidence linking benzene exposure to breast cancer. So this is a feminist issue. It causes birth defects as well. And so it also violates our reproductive rights, right? The flip side of Planned Parenthood, the right to kind of contracept and control your reproduction, is the right to have a pregnancy, to plan a parenthood without other people's chemicals sabotaging it. And benzene is one of those pregnancy sabotaging chemicals. So a pregnant woman living in a community with drilling and fracking operations, that to my mind is a feminist story.
Yeah, how to get this out with so much control of the government officials blocking this. Let me just mention this article. I want to get to one part of it where you told a story of this smackdown of the head of the Medical Association of Pennsylvania by a government official. But I would like listeners to know about your essay in the current issue of Orion. I've mentioned The Fracking of Rachel Carson, and then the subtitle is Silent Spring. That was, of course, her famous book that set off the environmental movement 50 years ago. Silent Spring's Lost Legacy Told in 50 Parts. So this is an essay with 50 short entries. And
it is,
It's very poetically written, but I want to mention to the readers there are photographs that Orion put into the layout accompanying this essay that really tell a lot of the story Sandra Steingraber was just relating. And you'll see a picture of someone who used to lead these rafting trips down a river, and he's standing there watching this methane bubble up in the river now. And there's a couple with a farm. They turn their faucet on and put a match to it, and it lights. So that's what's happened to their water, and there are people who have to lug water in for themselves, their horses. And then the industrialization of this rural landscape that she mentioned, you'll see that in these horrifying pictures, as well as the releasing into the atmosphere, this burning off of the early emissions when they drill a new well, pictures of that really give you an idea of what the effect is.
Yeah, I feel very lucky to. I mean, Orion does such a beautiful job with visual narrative as well as good writing, and so it was an amazing privilege for me to watch my words in this lyric essay, The Fracking of Rachel Carson, be interwoven with these amazing photographs by the photographer Nina Berman. And then in the online version of the magazine, readers can listen to me narrate a slideshow of some of those photographs. And so it really is words and documentary photography brought together, which is a new kind of project for me as an author. I don't usually deal with illustration, I'm kind of hooked on it now. And I, as you suggest, I wrote The Fracking of Rachel Carson in these 50 numbered parts from 1 to 50 to reflect in the structure of the essay the fracking, the fracturing of our landscape. And so I'm imagining each of these 50 parts almost like a broken pottery, like little shards of broken pottery that an archaeologist might number, you know, in catalog. And so I'm hoping that there are thematic connections that unite them, but it's an essay that's told in a fragmented form. I kind of blew up the rhetorical expository structure of an argumentative essay the way I might have learned to write it as an undergraduate. And so it's told the story of Rachel Carson and the fracking going on in her hometown. She grew up in Pennsylvania and her fracking in Allegheny County where she grew up. So I tell it in a fragmentary style.
Yeah, it's very poignant because you're talking about fracking and you're talking about Rachel Carson's message. People maybe connect her name with the alarm about DDT, but toward the end of her life, she was writing about environmental poisoning, pollution in general. Of course, her life was cut short by breast cancer.
She really had this idea that there were some technologies that were simply unregulatable and unmanageable and needed simply to be banned. And DDT, of course, is one of those. And I believe that fracking is another, and one of the things you just cannot manage through a regulatory process. So you just need to kind of close the door on that and look around for other options.
I wish you were the head of EPA saying that.
Well, anyway, listen, our voices need to be heard on it. We just need to find our words on this.
Well,
and I'm just one of many
organized
people
politically, it's very difficult when people are so bought off. But I want to just talk about this one section so the listeners will get a sense of what you're doing here. There's one part in this essay where you summarize what Rachel Carson said in the last address she gave, which was to a conference of 1,500 physicians and medical professionals. And she was offering explanations for our what you call collective reluctance to give up on poisonous technologies. And first she said, well, we wait too long to evaluate the risks. So once it's deployed, you know, a lot of environmental and political commitment is behind it. And second, we fail to acknowledge that nature invariably has its own unpredictable ways with harmful pollutants, of course. That's the dynamically interrelated nature of reality that is just ignored by the mechanistic model. Put it here, it'll be fine. And then third, we act as though the evidence for harm in other animals does not apply to us, even though we share biological ancestry and thus are clearly susceptible to damage from the same forces. This in spite of the fact that, quote, she said, it would be hard to find any person of education who would deny the facts of evolution, unquote. And your next entry is, oh, Rachel, if only you'd live to see what we're up against now.
Well, we're living in a very anti-scientific age, right?
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
even more than Rachel Carson, who kind of lived through the McCarthy era. Nevertheless,
right.
Science was held in much higher esteem, especially in the aftermath of Sputnik and so forth. And now, you know, we see members of Congress who are head of scientific committees freely making stuff up and calling it biology, like this idea that, you know, that women's bodies have some kind of ability to fend off the sperm of rapists, right? There's no biology at all for that. That's just made up. And this idea that, you know, global warming is, you know, due to sunspots. I mean, people just feel completely free now in a way that I don't think they did even in Carson's time, just to violate evidence-based reasoning.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there was not a big uproar when it came out that in the Bush administration, the editors in the White House would just change science reports. They would just change the data as they would put it into these larger reports. So, yeah, there's a horrible slide there. I just want to mention we're out of time, but one more observation you make in this article, no comprehensive study on the human or animal health impacts of fracking has been conducted. So, don't agonize organized folks, because this is coming to 30 states, and we have to have citizen action. As you can see, the parties are pretty complicit because of the campaign contributions. Okay.
And look, Charlene, I think this is a winnable fight. I really do. I want to emphasize that.
With
France has already banned it, right?
I completely
agree. France has banned
it.
Bulgaria has banned it. We can do this.
That's right.
But we need a political skill set, and so it's time to learn how to insert ourselves into this
how to
process.
Be effective. Absolutely. Well, we need to leave it there because of the time. But Sandra Steingraber, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Well, thank you. I'm just such a big admirer of everything you've done ever since your 1981 book on the politics of spirituality that really influenced me. So what an honor for me. Thanks, Charlene.
Oh, okay, thank you. Well, let's amble over into the arts corner now. And today we have a new poem by Mary Oliver. This was published just a few months ago in the May and June issue of, again, it's Orion Magazine Day today. It was in Orion Magazine. This poem is entitled Life Story. When I lived under the black oaks, I felt I was made of leaves. When I lived by Little Sister Pond, I dreamed I was the feather of the blue heron left on the shore. I was the pond lily, my root delicate as an artery, my face like a star, my happiness brimming. Later, I was the footsteps that follow the sea. I knew the tides. I knew the ingredients of the rack. I knew the eider, the red-throated loon with his uplifted beak and his smart eye. I felt I was the tip of the wave, the pearl of water on the eider's glossy back. No, there's no escaping, nor would I want this to escape, this outgo, this foot loosening, this solution to gravity and a single shape. Now I am here. Later I will be there. I will be that small cloud staring down at the water, the one that stalls, that lifts its white legs, that looks like a lamb. For our song today, let's see, what's appropriate for all this information we've been discussing about the current, not permanent, current situation regarding environmental toxins and fracking? How about this one, by the Stones? That was 19th Nervous Breakdown by the Rolling Stones. Of course, there's no need for all 19 of those breakdowns, folks, because we can change the situation, as I've said, with sufficient political will and activism. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Him Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week when my guest will be Francis Moore LaPay. Till then, this is Charlene Spratnak with All Together Now.